Hi, it's Amy Siskin of The Weekly List and author of the book, The List, and welcome to episode 147 of The Weekly List podcast. This is the 13th segment in a section called Democracy at Risk. Welcome. We record this podcast after some grave and dire news. On Friday, the Supreme Court, in a decision on a case called Jackson versus Hobbs, has overturned half-century-old precedent, taking away the abortion right of women in this country, overturning Roe v. Wade, and another case called Planned Parenthood versus Casey that affirmed women's right to control her own body and access to abortion being federally mandated. The ruling shocked the country, even though we had, as discussed in the past, it had been leaked that this might happen. It nonetheless came as a shock. We're going to be discussing that this week. We're also going to be discussing what's happening in the world in terms of authoritarianism and Putin's continuing invasion of Ukraine. And then we're going to discuss the January 6 hearings that have gotten underway. There have been six so far, including a surprise hearing yesterday where Congress had been called back from their July 4th weekend recess in order to hear from a surprise witness. So we will be covering all of that in this podcast, but we will start with our Supreme Court. And a subject we have discussed frequently as part of this project, because as we started this project in November 2016, one thing that Marcia Gessen had written in her prescient article, Surviving Autocracy, was to warn us that institutions won't save you. She had warned that the nation's highest court, frequently in authoritarian regimes, will be stacked with extremists. And the Supreme Court or the highest court will lose a public trust. Well, this past week, Gallup polling released a poll that found that just 25% of Americans, just one in four, have confidence in our Supreme Court. That is the lowest since Gallup started measuring such things. And it has never been below 30% prior to now. Some perspective. Confidence is down from 36% just last year to 25% this year. And that poll was taken before Roe was overturned. So you can see how the trust in this institution that has so much power in our country and is meant to be an institution that, in a way, even though not elected by the people, answers to the people in terms of following public sentiment and public opinion and progress that way. Well, this ruling on that overturns Roe has completely disregarded public opinion. Depending on the poll, 60 to 70% of Americans believe Roe should not be overturned. And yet, when we look at it in the specter of authoritarianism, one of the main tenets of authoritarianism is that women are viewed as second-class citizens, or in this particular ruling, just not recognized. The ruling on Hobbs was 5-4. The Supreme Court Chief Justice, John Roberts, has really tried to implore the more conservative justices to slow things down, but they, in this case, snubbed their nose at him. Hobbs was asking for a 15-week abortion ban. They've totally taken away abortion. And within that realm, in the opinion of Alito, who wrote the majority opinion, women and the impact on women is not even recognized. It's remarkable, despite there being briefs that talked about how this would impact women, not only their health, their ability to make a living, the impact on the economy, all that was disregarded. Also in authoritarianism, you know, we've seen a gradual degradation of rights by this Supreme Court of people of color with gerrymandering and ending voting rights. Next up on their agenda will likely be affirmative action being overturned. And we also are going to discuss the risk to gay rights. So increasingly, we are seeing religious sectarianism in our Supreme Court and this idea of the United States being a sort of Christian state, which is quite frightening. In addition to the ruling on Roe in recent weeks, there's been three rulings that have prioritized religion in a very frightening way. First, in the Supreme Court ruled most recently in favor of a Washington State football coach who was fired for leading prayer in the 50-yard line. They have voted in his favor. They voted in favor they voted against Maine, saying that Maine's state tuition cannot exclude families from using public school money for religious schools. And the third ruling was in favor of a Christian group in Boston that sought to fly a flag with a cross at Boston City Hall. So three major rulings that have taken the right of religion over something that is usually something that religions do not have these sort of priority rights in our country. This is the new direction our country is going with the Supreme Court. And shockingly, back to the Hobbs decision and what one particular justice who is particular conservative or far right, Justice Clarence Thomas, who continues to be on our Supreme Court and rule on all cases, despite the fact that his wife is increasingly embroiled in this January 6th coup, as a side note, but Clarence Thomas, who seems gleeful with these rulings, also suggested that the court should, quote, reconsider three major rulings that, similar to Roe v. Wade, were predicated on the 14th Amendment, and that being the basic right of people to, it's their own liberty, their right to liberty, their right to control their family and whether they have a family, like Roe v. Wade. He cited Griswold, which is contraceptives, basically taking away not only a woman's right to abortion and now having forced birth in the United States, but also the ability to protect against wanting to get pregnant with contraceptives. Talked about overruling that. Talked about Obergefell, which is gay marriage. Talked about we should also reconsider Lawrence, which is same-sex intimacy in this country. He didn't mention Loving, which is interracial marriage, but all of these cases, which are progress that our country has made, are based on the same kind of thinking that is put Roe in place. So you can see as dominoes how all of these things might fall next. In addition to this religious secularism, which as a side note, a historian friend, David Michaelis, who wrote most recently a biography of Eleanor Roosevelt, said the Supreme Court has basically steamrolled everything the U.S. government has done from 1933 to 1981. So this is the period in which we are currently living. Three of these justices, three of the nine and three of the five who ruled on Hobbs, were put in place during the Trump era. Two of these seats were conceivably stolen seats. One was Merrick Garland's seat, which was then given to Gorsuch. Gorsuch, in his hearings in the Senate, had told senators they could rely on him not to overturn Roe v. Wade and to rely on precedents. One was Kavanaugh, who, according to Susan Collins and Joe Manchin, were the two votes that gave him the seat, Susan Collins being a Republican and Manchin being a Democrat. Again, he had assured them both in private meetings that he would not overturn Roe v. Wade and that it was a law of the land and settled law. Again, these words are out the window now, and Americans feeling powerless. We have five activist judges who, see this as their opportunity, and they're impatient, and they are going to move forward with this very, religious-based view, very white Christian state kind of view of what the United States should be. Frightening times we are in. So we're going to be talking, obviously, more about that in the coming weeks and the impact that this Supreme Court has on our country and how we got here and its role in authoritarianism. But next, I want to just briefly discuss what's happening on a global scale with our battle with authoritarianism versus democracy. Most recently, we have discussed Putin's invasion of Ukraine, his unprovoked invasion of Ukraine that is now several months in. He had counted on this being a war of attrition. In other words, when we looked at authoritarianism versus democracy, in democracies, the leaders need to answer to their people. So when things get dire in our country and gas prices are high because of Putin's war and there's inflation that has been worsened by this war, he was banking on the United States and other Western countries, democracies, backing down because people would be unhappy and they would need to back down. That has not happened. Meanwhile, back at home, where Putin has a total grip on his country, including on the media, all they hear now is propaganda in his country, his people will have no choice but to put up with the suffering that his war has caused on them. And he had counted on this attrition, but as recently as this last week at the G7 meeting, Biden and other leaders have affirmed their commitment to backing Ukraine and sending needed weapons and other materials as millions have been forced to flee and as tens of thousands on both sides, huge casualties for the Russian people as that continues. Also in major news and an unintended consequence for Putin's invasion here, just this week, both Finland and Sweden have been admitted to NATO. So not only has NATO been revived, it is now expanded, including Finland along Russia's border. President Biden today affirmed that the United States will be sending more troops to Europe to protect NATO than it has in decades. So not what Putin had planned on, but where we sit today. He continues his brutal, bloody invasion, unprovoked, and the Ukraine people are steadfast with a poll out today saying 89% of the Ukrainian people are against ceding any of their land to Putin in order to make his invasion stop. Also on a global basis, elections in Latin America, interestingly, have elected leaders that are far left. In Chile, Honduras, and most recently in recent weeks in Colombia, far left leaders have taken over. Brazil has an upcoming election that could topple one of the authoritarians in our world there. So watching closely, but just generally, you do see a move away from these authoritarian-backed governments. Okay, so now we're going to talk about the January 6th hearings. And one of the things that you have heard me complain about in several of these podcasts is we are already in June, and tomorrow is the first day of July, 2022. And this happened January 6th, 2021. Other than last summer when there were some public hearings held by the January 6th House Select Committee, largely, everything they've done has been in private, other than these intermittent leaks that we get that are newsworthy, but after a while, it just becomes, you know, everyone's just tuned out to it, and people are really not following, and it feels like that those involved have gotten away with it. Not necessarily the minions, but the people who incited it and encouraged it for their own ends. So, as this started, that had been my reservation, but I must say, credit where credit is due. The January 6th House Select Committee has done an amazing job in their presentation so far. It started on June 9th. We are now 3 weeks away from that. There have been a total of 6 hearings. And notably, as we talk about this Select Committee, Kevin McCarthy made a strategic decision, and it looks like at this point a faulty decision, not to include Republicans who he wanted to include on the Select Committee. Pelosi did give him a chance to pick a certain number to be part of the committee, and the people he picked would have made this into a clown sideshow, as usually happens when you have people like Jim Jordan and Matt Gaetz and these Trump sycophants who just make it into a circus. So not having them on it, but nonetheless having two Republicans, Liz Cheney and Adam Kinzinger on it, does make it nonpartisan. Cheney is in the fight of her life to keep her seat in Congress. She's up for re-election and being primaried. Kissinger, like many of the Republicans who had either been anti-Trump or had voted to impeach him, chose not to run for re-election. So it is bipartisan, but you don't have the voices that have Trump's back. And it's very noticeable as you watch these hearings that they seem professional, which for those of us who have been watching hearings over the last decade and more, you know, where these people just make a joke of and a mockery of every hearing, this has been refreshing in that way. And the committee made the very wise decision, as we go through these six hearings, I'm going to give you a little summary of all six. They made the very wise decision to primarily call Republicans to testify. And a lot of the Republicans who have testified were part of the Trump regime, and some very loyal to him, like Bill Barr, for example, like his daughter, Ivanka, and son-in-law, Jared Kushner. So what they have been successful in doing is telling the story through Republicans, and not, even though not having Republicans that are pro-Trump on this committee. So that's really a set up a paradigm that is very beneficial and very smart by Nancy Pelosi, who was a brainchild behind this, as well as Benny Thompson, who's the chair of the committee. And the vice chair is Liz Cheney, who is a Republican. So, I, you know, noticeably as well, as you read the coverage of it, it's been reported that they have TV producers on staff that are helping them with a rollout. And that's very noticeable. You know, just describing how it feels like you're watching entertainment. It's very well done. They have videos going in some parts, and then they bring in live witnesses. It's very organized. It flows very well. The sequence of things makes sense. It is like someone produced a TV series. So, you know, again, bravo so far. I'm just going to kind of walk through the first five, and then we're going to talk about the six, which was an unscheduled hearing that I thought was the most impactful with all the drama surrounding it, and talk about made for TV. But just one of those hearings that I think all of us will remember for our lifetime. The first hearing was 2 hours long. It was on a Thursday evening. And they opened it up by trying to, I think, remind us of what happened. There were snippets of dozens of pre-taped videos from that day, just to remind us how violent it was, how scary it was. Again, we all watched this happen live on TV. They put in pre-taped videos of testimony of Trump's Attorney General Bill Barr, Ivanka Trump, as well as Jared. And it was a very interesting kind of rollout because you had Barr saying that there was no election fraud and that he told Trump this and repeating that, and then Ivanka agreeing with Barr. So, of course, the internet was exploding with sarcasm that, you know, finally she's out, you know, the first daughter is out the door. And of course, Trump did make some snide comment about her on Truth Social. He's not allowed back on Twitter. But it was surprising to see Ivanka basically turn on her father. There was also, you know, a lot of footage of from Capitol Police body cameras, as well as two witnesses, one of whom was a Capitol Police officer named Carolyn Edwards. And her story was just breathtaking. And just, you know, she talked about what it was like, that she was not trained to for hand-to-hand combat. This was like army combat. She was trained as a police officer. And, you know, she described the waves of attack by the Proud Boys and the Oath Keepers and other hate groups that were incited by Trump. She said, quote, "I saw friends with blood all over their faces. I was slipping in people's blood." Brian Sicknick, who was the officer who died, one of the officers who died at the attack, his family also attended. And the focus really in this first hearing was on how Trump influenced hate groups like the Oath Keepers and the Proud Boys, and their involvement in actually leading this coup. So you had, again, these voices of Republicans and these voices of Trump's family piped in from pre-recorded interviews. And again, it sort of functioned as a reminder, sort of like, you know, this is how bad it was, folks. Here's the footage. A lot of it had never been seen before. And they started to include as well, there was a documentary made by a British documentary maker who was able to get inside access to Trump and his family and was there, embedded himself with these hate groups as they marched to the Capitol. So there's going to be more coming out from that, but he had footage and some of it was at that first hearing that we had never seen before. The second hearing started off by reminding us that about 840 people have been charged so far, including some Proud Boys and some leaders as well of the Oath Keepers. But Trump and his inner circle who incited it have faced no consequences. This hearing, I thought one of the most interesting takeaways was that Trump was able to raise $250 million off of his supporters in the weeks after the election by sending these rapid texts and emails saying that he needed money to fight against this stolen election, when obviously it wasn't stolen, and very little of the $250 million is accounted for, which in and of itself might be a crime. Most of that money Trump kept and is, you know, he'll still have if he tries to run for 2024. All the testimony in the second hearing came from Republicans via these snippets of their interviews. Bill Stepien, Jason Miller, who was a campaign advisor, saw Jared Kushner and Ivanka again, and Bill Barr, who described Trump as detached from reality, and saying that he was using this whack-a-mole strategy to try to come up with any excuse to try to say there was massive fraud, which Barr said there was not. The third hearing was focused on Mike Pence and the plan that Trump had hatched, reportedly through John Eastman, for Pence to overturn the election. Basically, the plan was on January 6th for him not to certify in favor of Biden. And again, you had Republicans testifying that they had told Eastman and they had told Pence that there was no grounds, legal grounds, for him to do so, that it would lead to a constitutional crisis and could lead to violence in the street. And it turned out that was what Eastman was hoping for. That they wanted to have this kind of thing where, you know, the ceremony of Pence not certifying as his job, which is a ceremonial job as vice president to do. And so what happens then? Would the Supreme Court take the case? Part of it was Eastman hoping, and there were emails leaked, that the Supreme Court would feel intimidated and not want to do it. So they would leave it to the people, and to basically a revolution was the term that was thrown around, where people would fight it out on the streets for who would be the next president. Obviously, that wasn't legal. At the end, Pence, who was made out to be a little bit more of a hero than I think he should be, given what he, you know, what he allowed to happen before, during, and after all of this. But the startling thing was, even after the violence, when our Senate and House and Pence did reconvene to certify the election, even after the attacks, Eastman again tried to reach out to Pence and again ask him not to certify the election. It also came out that the Pence came very close to getting killed, that the rioters were within 40 feet of him when they entered the Capitol. And also of note, Eastman emailed Rudy Giuliani after January 6th to ask to be on a pardon list. You're going to hear a few more of these, but he knew what he was doing was sketchy, so he was already asking for a pardon. The fourth hearing was just, to me, the most heartbreaking hearing of all. This was on election workers and elected officials who are being threatened by Trump supporters because of his rhetoric. First, Rusty Bowers, who is the Republican Speaker of the Arizona House, who refused Trump's overtures to either put in fake electors or to say there was massive fraud. He had Trump supporters swarm his house, and for weeks would have giant trucks that blared videos calling him a pedophile or other things and pass by his house, in addition to the death threats and all the rest of the rhetoric he received. In Georgia, Gabriel Sterling, who's a top election official, a Republican, and Brad Raffensperger, who was a Secretary of State, spoke out about the threats and violence that they had seen. Raffensperger said that Trump supporters broke into his daughter-in-law's house and threatened his wife with sexual violence. Notably, his son is dead, so his daughter-in-law was alone in the house with her kids when Trump supporters broke in. Also heartbreaking, an election worker from Georgia named Wandrea Moss, a Black woman who that day of the election had worked with her mother, Ruby Freeman, as election workers during the 2020 election. Both Trump and Giuliani lied that these two had rigged the election. Moss said, "There is nowhere I feel safe." And her mother said, "Do you know what it feels like to have the President of the United States target you?" Trump supporters even broke into their grandmother's home. They both said they were afraid to go out to the supermarket, afraid to give their name when they ordered food in the store, lived in fear every day for what Trump supporters might do to them, all because of the big lie. The fifth hearing was about the Department of Justice and Trump's attempt to involve the DOJ in overturning the election. And after Barr stepped down because he wouldn't go along with this stuff and said that the election did not have massive fraud, Trump had an acting attorney general who would not do his bidding. So he tried to install Jeffrey Clark, who was an unqualified assistant attorney general for the environmental division. Trump tried to make him into the attorney general. And again, you had Republicans speak that day about how they threatened to resign if that had happened. They batted that idea down and said how ridiculous it is to have an environmental lawyer who has never tried the case as head of as attorney general. And they showed a slide of a number of people, senior people that were assisting attorney generals who also had threatened to resign. Ultimately, Trump didn't go through with that plan, as we know, but it was only because he would have faced massive resignations. And they told him people on the lower rungs are not going to listen to some new guy who just steps in at your bidding into this role. Also notably, right as this hearing was starting, we learned that the FBI had actually raided Jeffrey Clark's home. So that was happening. That news was hitting right before this hearing started. After the hearing, in the days ahead after the hearing, we also learned at that same day of the fifth hearing that the FBI had seized John Eastman's phone the same day as raiding Clark. Also noteworthy that day, Cassidy Hutchinson, who we're going to hear more about, who was a White House staffer, said six Republican congressmen asked for pardons, including Mo Brooks, Matt Gaetz, Louis Gohmert, Andy Biggs, Marjorie Taylor Greene, Scott Perry. And Scott Perry is the one who introduced Jeffrey Clark to Trump. So again, another theme you're hearing with this is all, you keep hearing me use the word Republican. Now, other than a couple of folks that I'm mentioning here, like the election worker in Georgia, these people that are testifying are all Republicans. And again, many of them work in the Trump regime or a couple were related to him. Now, we thought we were done with these hearings until after July 4th recess for the House of Representatives. But we got a sudden alert that there would be a surprise hearing and that members of Congress who were at home in their districts involved in the Select Committee would be coming back to DC on Tuesday for this hearing. We didn't know who the witness was, but it was one witness that was going to be the subject of this hearing, this sixth hearing. So, you know, like a good TV drama, everyone was curious and speculating who the witness would be. Because we already knew that so many were not cooperating and were either getting subpoenaed and others are going, we're still waiting to hear from our Department of Justice what happened to Mark Meadows and Steve Bannon and others who, you know, have defied subpoenas and not testified. So it turns out that the surprise witness is Cassidy Hutchinson, who you've just heard me mention. But when she worked in the White House, just to be more specific, she was a trusted, longtime senior aide to the chief of staff at the time, Mark Meadows. She worked in the West Wing. She had direct contact not only with Trump and his staffers, but also was a go-between to Capitol Hill. She was a former aide to Steve Scalise, a senior member of the House of Representatives, very well thought of in Republican circles, a woman in her late 20s. And she had already given testimony by video, and we had seen her again when I mentioned the pardons. That was something she said in the fifth hearing. But here she was in person. And you could have guessed that this was coming, although not the significance of it, because she had switched from a Trump-funded lawyer to a lawyer that she picked. And so it was kind of clear that she might break off and become a star witness. And she was. She was extremely compelling, the most compelling, and her testimony the most impactful of anything we had heard yet. I think many people in the country watched it. Many commented it was one of the most, you know, strong and impactful kind of testimony they had seen in any case since Watergate, maybe including Watergate. So just some of the tips of the waves. And this was the first time that the lawyers who have been kind of watching this case, the lawyer pundit, said Trump might actually have criminal liability here. When Trump, on the day of January 6th, we knew that he had summoned the Proud Boys. He had said, stand by and stand back and stand by during the primary. And he had been, you know, kind of extolling everyone on Twitter that something big was coming and to be there at the Ellipse. And it was going to be a big day. And you could see the Trump supporters coming to D.C. So at this rally at the Ellipse, Hutchinson testified that Trump knew about the threat from his supporters, that he told Secret Service, who was not allowing in a lot of his supporters because some had, according to reports that the January 6th committee showed, they played like police communicating with each other and in videos. There were Trump supporters with AR-15s and other weaponry. They were dressed, you know, with carrying weapons. And in order to go into the Ellipse, they had to pass through a metal detector, and a lot of them didn't want to. So they were standing back, you know, behind. Trump wanted them closer to show that he had a big crowd and for the pictures. And so he told the security officials, they are not here to hurt me, and encouraged them to take down the metal detectors and let his people in. So that is an important fact, because when he then encouraged these same people to go march to the Capitol and don't let them steal this election from you, he knew he was sending armed supporters to the Capitol where Congress was trying to certify the election results. He also tried to join them, according to Hutchinson, made multiple tries. And after he was told no, and he got on in the Suburban, which was known as the Beast, I guess, the car that takes him. They told him he had to go back to the White House, according to her, and the Secret Service has not confirmed this, that Trump literally tried to grab the steering wheel and take himself to the Capitol because he wanted to be there with his people. He had been told that that could create huge liability for him, but nonetheless, he wanted to go. When he got back to the White House, reportedly he threw his lunch at the wall in the cafeteria, in his cafeteria area, after he saw a story that Bill Barr had declared there was no widespread voter fraud. And as Hutchinson tells it, there was ketchup on the wall. So he was steaming mad, but he was excited watching his supporters doing what they were doing. He refused to call off his supporters, even as they were threatening Pence. We know, obviously, he also sent a tweet encouraging them to threaten Pence. At one point, Hutchinson was with Meadows, and Meadows and Cipollone, the White House counsel, came in to tell Meadows he had to do something and get Trump to call it off and to, you know, call for peace and tell them to stop. And Meadows said, you heard him, Pat. He thinks Mike deserves it, this being Mike Pence, and Cipollone being concerned that Pence was going to be killed, and said he doesn't think they are doing anything wrong. These are his supporters. She also said that Trump's cabinet considered the 25th Amendment after the attempted coup on January 6th. And it was only him recording the video the next day, claiming to be committed to a peaceful transition of power, that prevented them from moving forward with that. She also said that Meadows and Giuliani both asked for pardons after this was all over. And when she described Meadows' behavior, first of all, she said he was already meeting with Giuliani and discussing this on January 2nd. And he seemed to know everything that was going on. In fact, Meadows was planning to meet up at the Willard Hotel with Roger Stone and the leaders of the Proud Boys and Oath Keepers and others to plan January 6th. But only last minute, he didn't go in person. So you get the sense, you know, very strongly from her testimony that not only did Trump and Meadows know what was going on, they did nothing to stop it. And that Trump knew he was sending violent people and wanted to join them in this attempted bloody coup. So again, for the first time after this hearing, we started to hear about criminal liability for Trump. You know, again, knowingly encouraging supporters who are armed to march to the Capitol and continue to fan the flames during the day rather than call them off. Also, her testimony opens a lot of different doors. In the days subsequent, the House committee has subpoenaed Pat Cipollone to get his testimony. We know Meadows thus far has refused, but things that Meadows put in his own book now appear to be a lie. Meanwhile, the Department of Justice is on a parallel track. And again, in order for us to have any justice come out of all of this, it's got to be the Department of Justice that indicts. The House committee can come up with a report. They can educate the American people. They can make recommendations. And please, I hope they do, and make very strong ones while we're still in control of the House and Senate, for changes. You know, for example, the vice president role, which is ceremonious only, that needs to be codified. We cannot go through this again. So, you know, hopefully that happens. But we have yet to see from the Department of Justice, and in many ways it appears that they're lagging, a single indictment. Again, there could well be things going on behind the scenes. As I mentioned, both John Eastman and Jeffrey Clark have both been either raided or their cell phone was raided by the FBI last week. So perhaps things are moving forward. But you see so many people that had their hands, Giuliani, on behalf of Trump, to overturn the results of an election. Seditious conspiracy. Where are the charges? So, yeah, I just want to close out with, as dire as this sounds and wow and whatnot, the country is still split. About half of Americans in polls taken say that Trump should be indicted. Others are concerned that it will appear as if the opposition party is indicting a former president. And the question becomes as well, from that perspective, who is watching? Are Trump and his loyalists watching these hearings? As shocking as they are, do they know any of this that I'm talking about? And that's the problem with having propaganda. That's the problem with having Fox, quote, news, OAN, which is not holding these hearings, and Newsmax. If that's your ecosystem, you know very little of what is actually happening. So, again, we're going to continue on these themes, and please be involved, folks, for our democracy right now. We have midterm election coming up. It's very important people are engaged. We started off talking about the Supreme Court. There's a lot happening now that deserves your attention and your engagement. Signing off.